Good evening, everybody. James McGanney here with my science hour. This is for February 22nd, 2024, in its 24th commercial free year. And I can't believe we are almost at the end of February, 2 months out of this year, already gone, almost gone, and a lot of topics, many, many topics to cover tonight. So glad you're here. By the way, the web page has been restored. So if you've been looking for archives on my web page, they are there. You can also join my Patreon channel, listen to the radio shows there. They're posted every week. Also, there are many platforms. What would you call them? Podcast platforms where the show airs. But I don't talk about that here because I want you going to my page. So let me dive right into the first topic here. The last few weeks I've been talking about a company called Intuitive Machines, and they have a rover that today, about the time this show airs, is supposed to be landing on the moon. So it would be the first private company to succeed. Three private companies have attempted this previously and failed, including this company, the Intuitive Machines company. They had a probe that had a failure. Anyway, I've been talking about this over the last number of weeks because NASA has been leaking kind of innuendos that, doggone, where they're going to land, it looks a little bit rougher than our alleged Apollo lunar landing sites that you've seen in pictures and movies. And so they're trying to cover their tracks. I call it the NASA lunar surface credibility problem. And so anyway, if you've been listening to my previous week's shows, I've been talking about this because if an independent lander gets onto the moon, now we're going to see the lunar surface. And in two probes have landed where we've gotten a completely different view of the lunar surface. One was from India, one was from China. And so these were recent, and definitely the lunar surface doesn't look at all like the Apollo warehouse photographs. In fact, it's rather comical because this past, well, I don't know when the video was released, but they're tow-towing the advancements of NASA and landing on the moon, etc. And they're saying, oh, but now you can't see the Apollo landers because they're covered with dust. I was like, wait a minute, boys and girls. They supposedly sent astronauts to the moon in 1969 and thereafter a few missions to gather lunar surface rocks and dust, telling us that that was from 4.5 billion years ago during the formation of the solar system. And now they're saying all of the surface is covered within a 20 years, 30 year span or 40 years, whatever. Span, and or 50 years, 60 years, whatever it is. But relative to 4.5 billion years, that's a very short time, a very, very, very short time. And so to be completely covered to the dust to the point where you can't see it anymore. So that's why you can't see the Apollo lunar landing sites anymore, according to NASA. It's pretty bizarre. But anyway, next week, I don't have any real information coming back from the Intuitive Machines landing, if they succeeded or anything, at showtime. So, but I'll have a report next week. I thought it would be, I would have some information this week, but no, we'll have to wait until next week. This is interesting. A listener wrote in last week, and I had been talking about the Super Bowl, some of the kind of funny things that happened in the coaching world during the Super Bowl game. And so the listener complained about me talking about football on my show. Well, I wrote back and I said, I'm not going to mention the name on air, but I said, have you purchased anything from my webpage? And the answer came back, no. So I'm thinking to myself, well, here's somebody that never purchased anything, not even to support the show, and wants to tell me what I'm supposed to talk about and not talk about on my radio show. Well, after reading a little further, this guy is living in his van, and so I felt a little bad. I didn't want to, give him too much grief. But that just kind of shows you the state where people are at out there. And so I'm planning on sending him some of my books because he said he would buy some of my books, but he doesn't have the money and he didn't know which ones to buy. So I'm going to just send him some versions of my ebook this coming week. And, I don't know. We're living in a very strange world today. It's certainly not like it was even 10 years ago, whatever. So, this listener, if you know who you are, I'll send you some books and then you can read them, no cost. Okay, now here's an interesting story, and this is something I don't cover much in the world of astronomy, astrophysics, and space science, but radar or radio telescopes, using them to image things in outer space like asteroids and comet nuclei and the lunar surface, etc. Now, for example, they used radar to image the surface of Venus. This is way back in the day. This is back in the Carl Sagan days, in the 70s, when Carl is leading the march against Velikovsky. And, of course, buried Velikovsky. But anyway, one of the proofs that Venus was an old planet, of course, Velikovsky was claiming that Venus was a young planet, which it is. It is a young planet. But anyway, they turned the radio telescopes to Venus to image the surface, and it came back with thousands and tens of thousands of craters. And so anyway, okay, you got a lot of craters on Venus, and so they said, okay, well, that's like the moon, because these craters indicate the impact during the original formation of the solar system, which, of course, they still believe is 4.5 billion years ago. There's no proof of that of any kind. It's like a mother goose nursery rhyme. They just keep repeating it until it's true. And so anyway, that gets mixed into the arguments or the output that they have for you, the public, to hear. But anyway, back in the Carl Sagan days, mid-70s, this idea that Venus is a young planet because it's certainly not Earth-like. They actually expected there would be dinosaurs and under this very heavy cloud cover, clearly that Venus had very huge atmosphere, very heavy cloud cover, and they literally expected to be fern forests and dinosaurs walking around. So anyway, turns out that it's extremely hot surface because of the Russian probes, we know that. But anyway, back to training radar or the radio telescopes onto the surface of Venus, what they discovered is that there were tens of thousands of craters. So they immediately thought that these were impact craters from the origin of the solar system, and therefore proving that Venus was an old planet of the same caliber as Earth being old, and verifying the assumption and very circular reasoning, trying to verify that Venus was an old planet, like with the rest of the members of the solar system, 4.5 billion years old. But the problem is when the Magellan spacecraft, which was another radio experiment, when the Magellan spacecraft went around Venus, it was mapping. It went around for an entire year, and so anyway, the a Venusian year. So anyway, what happened is it mapped the entire surface of Venus. And so they said it when it got done with its mission, it still had enough power left, it was doing well. So they said, well, let's just remap the surface that was before, which we already measured. It was totally different. It had completely changed. Where there were craters before, there were depressions. Where were there mountains before? There were craters. And so what they realized was that the surface of Venus is this bubbling ooze, not 4.5 billion year old craters, like Carl Sagan assumed. By the time the Magellan spacecraft came around, Carl wasn't really on the scene anymore. So anyway, this is a good example, a really good example of radio telescopes' ability. In other words, long before we sent a spacecraft up to Venus, we could read the surface condition of Venus. And they would have been able to tell, if they would have done and continued that experiment, they would have been able to tell that Venus' surface was changing. But now, fast forward to the 2024, there are some new telescopes coming online that will be much better suited to high-definition radio telescope imaging. Now, remember that the, say, for example, the Deep Space Network telescopes, there are three of them. There's one by Madrid, Spain. There's one in Canberra, Australia. And there's one in California, the Goldstone, I think it's called, over in California. But these three major telescope, radio telescope facilities are set at 120 degrees apart around the Earth, which gives you 360-degree coverage. Those were used, for example, for the Pioneer, for the Voyager spacecraft, for other spacecraft, the Venus orbiting spacecraft, and to do imaging. And so anyway, they, along with the Very Large Array, which is out in the middle of the desert in the American Southwest, a whole series of large telescopes that are on railroad tracks that they can change the distance between them, and this is called an interferometer, where you use multiple telescopes to image objects in outer space. But anyway, the point is, and I hope to be covering more of this in terms of hard science, is the imaging that's coming online now, some very advanced radio telescopes, will be able to, what they do is they send out a signal and that bounces off the surface and it comes back. And they're able to very accurately determine the structure, the surface structure of objects. So this could be used, for example, for asteroids or comet nuclei. So this is where it gets interesting because, for example, let's take an example. They would look at a comet. Okay, say they discover a comet. It's coming into the solar system. It's a big comet, like, say, Hale-Bopp. Okay, well, they have sky surveys that have been taken, and so with photographs, not radio telescopes, but with regular photography, or now digital photography, of course. And so they can isolate where that nucleus was before because nobody noticed it. It's just this little speck on a digital image with potentially millions of stars. So nobody ever really noticed that it was a comet, but they can go back by retro-calculating the orbit. They can say, okay, on this day it should have been here. They get the photographs out and they look at them, and then they want to determine the size of the nucleus. Okay, so they're assuming that they're assuming that the nucleus is this snowball, highly reflective albedo of near one, and they say, okay, well, based on that, and given the known amount of sunlight that reaches that part of the sky, that region of space, and given the fact that this object, believed to be a snowball, is reflecting nearly 100% of the light that reaches it, they say, okay, this is how big it is. But that's false because now we know that comet nuclei are black, some of the blackest objects in the solar system. So to reflect that same amount of light, this object has to be much bigger. And so this is where radio astronomy could come in and solve the issues because they're making these false assumptions using visible light photographs, photography. And with the radio telescopes, they could zoom in and look through the coma of the comet and determine the size of the nucleus. However, they don't do that, which is very interesting because as in the case of Hale-Bopp, which I pointed out, I've got a book on that, dealing with that. It's called The Real History of Planet X. And then there's another study that I've done that's published on my webpage. It deals with Hale-Bopp. That was the 10th anniversary of Hale-Bopp, the discovery of Hale-Bopp. And, or was it the 20th year? I think it was the 20th year. So it would have been 2015, July something. I forget the exact date in July. when Hale-Bopp was discovered in 1995, when it exploded into brightness as a big comet. But the nucleus of Hale-Bopp was very large. It was planet-sized. And that turns out to be the Planet X object that Harrington discovered. I talk about that in the whole litany of the hiding the discovery, getting rid of Harrington, Tom Van Flander and his assistant, who started the whole search for Planet X under contract to NASA, etc. Their findings, that whole thing I've explained in my book. But back to radio telescopes. Now they should be able to tell if objects are large, and typically comets are very small. The typical comet is very small, maybe a number of miles across. That's standard. But there are occasional large ones, like Hale-Bopp. And rather than depending on this hip pocket theorizing, using data and then assumptions mixed into that data to give you wrong results, you could be using radio telescopes to get a very exact measurement of the comet nucleus. And even the idea that it's growing, that it's getting bigger, could be determined very exactly with radio telescopes. So it opens up a whole new field, but don't expect this to happen. Don't hold your breath, because NASA cannot release any data that would contradict its Hale-Bopp theories. But anyway, you could do photography on Mars, the surface of Mars, etc. Very detailed, and the surface of the Moon. So at any rate, I'll be talking more about radio astronomy in future episodes of this show. By the way, my webpage is back together after being hacked. It was hacked in October, then rehacked in December. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but it was the J. McCanney Science page, not the water filter page, not the other pages. I've got four pages total now. But it was the J. McCanney Science page, which the short URL is jmccsci.com. And that contains a lot of work, and it was originally redone like last summer to give it a modern format, because I had been using the old HTML style of web page, and I was maintaining it myself, and I decided to move it into the modern world for a number of reasons. And so in that process, finally around October, it got hacked, then in December again, and it's finally just getting put back together with all the radio shows. People were complaining that, hey, these radio shows are not there, my archives, the archives of my radio show. But anyway, so check that out, the webpage jmccsci.com. That links you to the J. McCanney Science webpage. Okay, so here's something I've talked about a number of times before, but now things are coming to fruition. This is in the world of hurricanes. Now, if you live along the U.S. eastern seaboard, or within 200 to even 300 miles of the seaboard, or if you live around Florida, the eastern coast, or the southern tip, or the western coast, Florida, or the Gulf Coast of Florida, and then the entire Gulf Coast, which wraps around to Texas, be prepared for some activity this year. Now, AccuWeather, which is basically, let's just say these are all CIA-owned entities, disinformation at its finest, owned through a bunch of levels of companies starting at the CIA. And, of course, they're pumping out disinformation about, and, of course, they're also pumping out the standard theoretical concept of how hurricanes form, that somehow they form from warm water, which is absolutely absurd. So I saw a presentation where the Mr. Johnny Very Nice Suit, and his assistant, the meteorologist, top meteorologist dealing with hurricanes at AccuWeather, that's ACCU weather, are saying that this year, 2024, hurricane season, which typically runs from June 1st to the end of November, or the, is it the 1st of November, I'm sorry, the standard hurricane season, it's going to be supercharged. And they're giving all the reasons that there's going to be a La Nina, so there won't be a high altitude wind shear, there won't be, there's excessively hot water in the Atlantic where hurricanes form. But none of these factors have anything to do with hurricane formation. Hurricanes are formed from electric fields in the between the Earth's surface and the ionosphere. That's what causes hurricanes. Probably about 15 years ago now, a guy named William Gray was the head of the Boulder, Colorado, NOAA, National Weather Service, National Weather Service dealing with hurricane predictions, the Hurricane Prediction Center. And he quit. One day, he hung up his hat and he went on, and he went public with his assistant. He had an assistant that was leaving with him. And he was the guy, he was the main man in hurricane prediction for probably about 20 years. And he went on camera and he says, I'm leaving, I'm quitting. None of what we have done in terms of hurricane examination of hurricanes is valid. It has no validity at all. And especially the hurricane predictions, what they're basing hurricane prediction on. And it was probably a laundry list of about 20 major items, a few minor items that were relative to hurricane production. He said all of that is false. And I know what he was doing. He understood that my work is correct, that hurricanes have nothing to do with warm water, salt content in the water, high altitude wind shear, El Nino, La Nina. I mean, you go down the laundry list of things that they had listed there in their computer models, and he said out loud on camera, said none of this has anything to do with reality. And so anyway, but these organizations continued, government funded, and then there were the Weather Channel was another channel that went away, and there were all of these other semi-legitimate weather sources, information that took the GOES satellite imagery and information, converted it into weather prediction, etc. All of that went away overnight, and these entities like AccuWeather all of a sudden pop out of nowhere and take complete control of the meteorological weather scene and promoting and giving information, especially over the internet. So, anyway, I talked about this situation that, this was probably a year ago, half a year ago. There were shows coming out, and these were production shows, and they were saying that global warming or global climate change was causing the seas to warm up, and this would cause hurricanes of unprecedented strength and numbers, and they would go farther inland, and they would also go farther north. So typically we think of Florida as a place where you would have, you know, hurricane insurance, or if you didn't, you would be very expensive for your house. And that's what we typically would consider as the, say, the hurricane belt in terms of house insurance. And so what they were saying is, oh no, gloves are off, everything is going to change, the hurricanes are going to go much farther north and much farther inland. So they were saying 20 to 30 times potentially the number of houses that could be affected by hurricanes. And of course, none of this is true. It's all hocus pocus that somehow global warming is causing more hurricanes. It's just garbage. That has nothing to do with that at all. Hurricanes are formed by electrical conditions. In fact, 99% of our weather, including the wind, tornadoes, cyclonic storms, hurricanes, thunder, lightning, all of these are effects of the vertical electric field, which is powered by the Earth discharging the solar capacitor, and ultimately the solar capacitor, which is driving all the weather systems on all the planets in the solar system, except Jupiter and Saturn, have their own fusion-based engines, heat engines, which are also affecting their weather patterns. But all the other planets, including Earth, have their weather completely dominated by the electrical currents in the solar system and have nothing to do with solar light. Absolutely nothing. And so, and certainly nothing with warm water. Some of the biggest hurricanes in history have been in the North Atlantic in the middle of winter. Where's the warm water? We see hurricanes on Mars. Where's the warm water? It's absurd. It doesn't make any sense at all. So anyway, the AccuWeather comes out this past week and makes this gigantic announcement that this year is going to be supercharged, and they give all of their reasons. And it's also helpful if they have a little bit of help from the military friends with the laser satellites, which are able to manipulate hurricanes to drive them up into a much higher energy state and enhance them, let's say, with laser satellites. And I talk about that in my weather book, Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather. I go into all of the details of how this works and how the U.S. military started using laser satellites in the early 2000s. You know, everybody talks about HAARP and all these other weather-controlling techniques. Those are all old technology. Nobody uses those anymore. You know, as soon as they got wind of this, the use of satellites to manipulate weather and long-term weather patterns, now that's what they're doing. They can control long-term weather patterns now with the same type of technology. It's just, it's a matter of maintaining the low-pressure cells. It's a matter of maintaining, and the low-pressure cells are maintained by cyclonic storms, which the is basically like a vertical current that reduces the pressure at the surface of the ocean, or at on land. It's the same thing. There are storms, I call them himicanes. They are overland hurricanes. In fact, the perfect storm, remember the movie The Perfect Storm, was out in the Atlantic, North Atlantic in November. These storms came through, one came up through the Smoky Mountain region, one came up the East Coast, so that was actually a hurricane out in the ocean, and the other one came across 1991, it was in the great October, the great Halloween blizzard of 1991, and it came across the basically the line between Canada and the United States and met with these other two storms out in the Atlantic to form what was known as the perfect storm. But here you have the biggest hurricane in recorded history out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean in ice freezing water. So where was the warm water that fueled and maintained these hurricanes? Absolutely absurd. It has nothing to do with warm water. Yet they're pushing this agenda that somehow they can predict this. And then, get this, the insurance companies can say, okay, now we have it. It's official. This reputable agency, AccuWeather, is telling us that there's going to be all of this hurricane activity. So, gee, doggone it, homeowners, get ready to get your insurance bill doubled or tripled overnight and without any hurricanes at all. And let me tell you something about insurance companies, where they make their money. They make it sound like when you pay your premium and there's a big event, then they that covers the losses. And they lose money. That's not true at all. The insurance companies never lose money. They raise your rates. By definition, it's like Las Vegas. It's like insurance companies can't lose money. They simply raise the rates in future years. And believe me, they make it all back. But the payout, the real way insurance companies make money is in the good times. They buy buildings. You know, what's the biggest building in town? First, it's the government building. Go to any city. If there's a federal building, that's the biggest building. If there's a state building, that's the second biggest building. What's the third biggest building? The insurance buildings. Look at them. And what do? They rent out the space. So they invest your money. They're getting rent from all of these businesses. And that's where they make their money. So when they have to pay out some money for a claim, that's like a drop in a bucket. It's a drop in the ocean compared to the amount of money they have. So don't let them make you feel bad. And especially now they're starting to charge for fakery. That somehow there's going to be major hurricanes and we got to charge these people more money for their house insurance. This is what's going on. It's called the old protection racket. Remember back in the old 1930s movie, the guy had a little shop, some kind of maybe selling vegetables or maybe a tobacco shop or something like that down in Chicago or one of the cities. And so anyway, one day the boys come in and say, you know, Pop, you need protection here. It's getting kind of rough out there, and you need protection. And Pop goes, well, you know, I've been here for 20 years. Everything's great. The local people love me, and I don't think I need your protection. I go, well, you know, okay. Well, you know, just that's your decision. Okay. So the boys leave. That night, Pop's store gets broken into, all smashed up, and next day, the boys come in and say, doggone it, Pop. You know, if you'd have just taken our protection, this wouldn't have happened. And so they get Pop to start paying them money. The old protection racket. Well, that's what the insurance racket is. It's the protection racket. Like, you pay them. So anyway, back to the original story here. This is official now. So with AccuWeather's recent announcement, this was just in the last couple of days. And now look at the timing on this. This is February. We're not even close to hurricane season. That's in June. But they're saying, ooh, wait a minute. This could move the hurricane season to much earlier than June 1st or much later than 1st of November. So they now, not only is the area that is potentially doomed for hurricane disasters, not only is that area expanded by tenfold, by a factor of 10 or whatever, but this severity of the storms is going to increase, but the dates when we could expect these are going to change. So anyway, this was interesting too. At the very end, they said, the people in Texas and Louisiana are more vulnerable. And I'm like, wait a minute. Whoa. Put on the reins here and pull this horse back in, buddy. Where on earth, given this general data that there's warming in the Atlantic Ocean of water, and who knows how fake that data. The data looked so faked that I couldn't believe it. But anyway, be that... doesn't matter if it's warmer or not. That has nothing to do with hurricane prediction. But at the very end, say the people in Texas and Louisiana are more vulnerable than, say, the East Coast, or how about North Carolina, South Carolina, how about, you know, Georgia, Florida, which is the sticks out there, is in the path of almost all hurricanes, have to pass somewhere by Florida. Whether it comes in the Gulf or whether it goes up the eastern seaboard, at some point it's pointed at Florida, and it's impossible to predict exactly where it might go. But why would somebody say Texas and Louisiana would have a larger probability in this scenario, which they've just generalized? There's no historical data, which they depend heavily on when they're doing hurricane predictions. What they do for hurricane predictions is they don't predict anything. What they do is they go back in historically. Here comes a hurricane. Here's what the weather patterns were like in the United States at the time. It went north and it went up here by the Carolina coast or something. And they look at what the hurricanes that were similar to this one did in the past, and they made predictions based on that. Then they do time averages and they go through, they crunch all of this data and they make some kind of prediction, but it has nothing to do with reality and rarely anything to do what actually turns out with these storms. So, you know, why would they say Texas and Louisiana? Unless they know something that you and I don't know. If the, say, the military, why would they target an area? That is just beyond bizarre, because there's no reason. There's certainly no scientific reason. There's certainly no meteorological reason. There's certainly no theory or even vague theory in weather prediction that would allow them to make that prediction. Where's that coming from? And they just say it. Like, believe us, boys and girls. Anyway, this is a story that's going to develop because it's going to affect a lot of people. A lot of people. Not only if there's a hurricane, but it's going to affect a lot of people in the pocketbook in terms of house insurance, your residential house insurance. Imagine if that doubled or tripled. Because there are people paying, you know, the average middle-income home is probably paying $1,000 to $1,500 a year insurance for house insurance. Imagine that tripled overnight. Hello? That's a lot of money. In an economy where people are hurting and just barely getting by, that would be like the... and that affects your house. That's not a bill that, you know, you can say, well, I'll pay it next year or something. No, you got to pay that right now or you're not insured. And most people have a house loan. So here's the scenario that would happen. Okay, your insurance goes up to the point where you can't pay it. You don't have the money. You're just barely making your house payments and putting gas in the car and getting to work and feeding the kids and paying for school and whatever else is going on in your lives. Okay, so you just barely make it. All of a sudden, you have a $3,000 bill piled on top of the current house bill. Okay, so you can't pay it on time. Guess what happens? That triggers the bank. The insurance company goes straight to the bank and says, hey, this guy didn't pay his house insurance. And you know what happens? The bank comes in. And now they're going to buy insurance on your house. And they're going to pay not what you're paying, but they're going to probably pay double or triple. And then you got to pay them back. Okay, the other thing is now you're not hearing this on the evening news, or probably not even on Tucker Carlson Network, which is very good. I'm very glad that Tucker started his own network. He's one of the few people out there you can listen to that's got half a brain, but there's a lot of stuff he misses too. And it would be a bit advantageous for his network to understand that science, you know, when you talk about fake news and science has been around for a lot longer than fake news and regular news. Fake news and science has been a big booming business for a very long time. You know, sending out fake information to you, the public, relative to science, or things like this, meteorology, and people listen to it and believe it. I noticed that now NASA has all these journalists. They're primarily young women who have a journalist degree of some kind, and they're just so excited about reporting the science news to you. And it's just full of disinformation because these people aren't trained. They're not good scientists. They don't have any training in science, and they have no ability to ask critical questions. And even if they did, they wouldn't. So science news reporting is on the table. It's on the mortician's table. Let's just put it that way. And this is probably one of the only places in the universe you're going to get any semblance of real information about science. Okay, on to the next topic here, Neuralink. This is Elon Musk's brainchild, literally, where they've implanted a brain chip into the some experimental humans that volunteered. Yeah, you got to kind of wonder about who's volunteering their body to have a neural chip put in the brain where they're connecting in. So it's allegedly... and the news has reported that the Neuralink subject is now able to control a mouse. If you can control a mouse, then you can control a computer. And so that is the word on the street. the neural link, and that would be the very first thing you'd want to control. If you can control a mouse, then you're in, basically. And of course, this would be a boon if you were a paraplegic. You could imagine that might be a benefit, but for you and me, that we have both our hands, I'm very fine just using the mouse that I've got right here and move it around and click on it like I'm used to doing. It's kind of like second nature. So I really am not looking to put in a Neuralink so that I can drive my mouse. Thank you very much. But where AI is going, once they start with the human brain interfaces, then the next question is, well, gee, you got to be programmed. And then you got to be programmed to read certain things, and you cannot, your mouse can no longer go to certain web pages. Okay, on to the next story. This is unbelievable. The United Nations passed another resolution for a ceasefire in the Gaza issue between Israel and Palestine. And the United States vetoed it. So they're hell-bent on shooting it out. I just cannot believe that the very first thing you have to do there is just stop the shooting. But the United States vetoes it. In other words, bring it on. You know, bring on as much shooting and death and destruction as you can. In support of Israel. There's two proxy wars going on for Israel right now. One is in Ukraine, one is in Gaza. And they're both regions that Israel has been trying to move into in recent years. So the United States is supporting this. A couple hundred billion dollars again off to Ukraine. Nobody knows where this money is going, what it's being spent on, who's getting it, how it's being funneled back to senators and congressmen. And their buddies. So anyway, going back to the topic of local electrical batteries now, got about a little less than half of this show I'm going to be talking about this, but I'm going to explain what these are and how they work. And because earlier in the show I was complaining about AccuWeather and the just horrendously bad science that these people are putting out about hurricanes. Doesn't make any sense at all that hurricanes somehow form from warm water. Violates the second, third principle of thermodynamic. The laws of thermodynamics say that you cannot take a general energy system and naturally concentrate it into a more concentrated energy system. In nature, it works the other way around, unless you have some energy source that's causing this to happen, and that's what I talk about, that yes, there are energy sources that are very large, and they're electrical, and they're ultimately powered by the energy from the sun. So anyway, let me go through this and give you an example. Okay, so the solar wind comes off of the sun. It's a high-velocity stream of electrons and protons, and actually, one of my great discoveries, one of my early discoveries, was I was looking for the charging process used in comets. And so what I discovered is that there was an excess current of protons in the solar wind, which created a capacitor, ultimately a capacitor. But notwithstanding that, say that there are nearly equal numbers of protons and electrons in the solar wind. But they're rushing out. Okay, and then we have Earth. Earth has a magnetic field. What happens when electrons and protons start to encounter a magnetic field? Well, the electrons bend one way and the protons bend the opposite direction. So if the electrons go right, the protons go left. But the protons are more massive by about a factor of 2,000. About 1920 to be more exact, but use 2000 as a ratio. So the mass of the proton is a couple thousand times greater than that of the electron, even though their charges are the same. So it's an unbalanced splitting of charge. But anyway, what happens then is here's the magnetic field of Earth extends out about 30,000 miles from Earth on the sunward side, and that varies, that moves back and forth. But the electrons go one way and the protons go the other way, and what do you have? A battery. It's a battery. It's a battery that forms because of the presence of Earth. And now Earth's magnetic field is a result of this current also, and other plasma effects. We have the Van Allen belts, which are two belts of high speed, high velocity radiation encompassing Earth. And those are linked into the magnetic field. We have the ionospheric jet streams, which are coupled with that. I'm not going to go into all of that detail tonight, but maybe I'll have some time at the end of the show to talk a little bit more about that. But here we have a battery forming naturally in outer space. And so what happens when this, say there's like a constant flow of electrons and protons in the solar wind, all of a sudden there's a solar flare. This pulse comes out, and there's a rapid change in the number of protons and electrons in the solar wind. Well, that creates an impulse, and there's like, let's compare it to, say, like water waves. Or say you put your hand in water, like in streams, and you push the water, you're going to feel resistance. So those protons and electrons have to slow down because they're trying to force their way through electrons and protons that are already out in front of them. So they split apart, and what does that do? That causes an overall pressure, a compression on this battery, this local electrical battery. So it's a plasma battery that surrounds Earth, and when that compression occurs, when a solar flare hits, that drives all the way down to the troposphere where we live. We live in the troposphere. That's the weather, the band of weather around planet Earth. Okay, so the electric field that comes from the ionosphere down to ground gets compressed. That means it drops down in altitude. That then causes a excessive current in the vertical electric field. And what happens? These big cloud systems are moving off of Africa. They're already attached to the vertical electric field. There's lightning coming off of them out of the bottom and out of the tops. And what is lightning? It's part of the electric field. It's part of the current in the vertical electric field. And so when those storm systems roll off of Africa over the west coast of Africa and out into the Atlantic Ocean, all of a sudden their nice electrical connection with ground goes away. And but the current is going to remain. There's the so where does that current come from? Well, it comes from ionized air that's around the surface of the ocean. So the air is ionized, it swirls in and it comes up to the finds a path, the very highest cloud. And if you watch hurricanes form, you find these cumulonimbus clouds rolling off the west coast of Africa, and the very tallest point is typically where the eye of the hurricane starts to form. So the currents are breaking through the top of the cloud and following that path, and what do? Because of the Coriolis force, they start to spin. It's like the water going down the drain in the bathtub, except it's going up. And so why do hurricanes move westerly? Well, it's the right-hand rule of electromagnetism. You have the positive current going up, you have the magnetic field as your first finger pointing north, and the force is your middle finger pointing to the left, which is west. That's why hurricanes move west. Of course, you ain't gonna hear this from the dudes, the bozos at AccuWeather, because they don't know it. And of course, they're being honest, but they're just stupid honest. You know, there's nothing worse than they say, what's the difference between a liar and a person that's stupid? Well, you know, not a lot. The person that's stupid giving you a bum story is just stupid. But they're equally liable for giving you bad information. Okay, so anyway, these, you know, people that wear a suit, they just bug me. because that is, you know, they try and impress you with the suit that they wear. Well, you know, if you're talking garbage, I don't care if you're wearing a nice $1,000 suit, buddy, at AccuWeather, and your meteorologist buddy that's wearing in a $500 suit, they don't impress me at all. Anyway, so back to the local electrical battery. This is one of the driving forces of hurricanes. We've seen hurricanes on Mars. Hey, buddy, there ain't no oceans, let alone warm oceans, on Mars. There ain't no water at all. There might be a little bit frozen somewhere, but there's no oceans, and there's no warm water, and there's certainly no salt in the warm water. So how do hurricanes form on Mars? Doesn't make any sense, according to the AccuWeather view of hurricanes. They're just peddling pure garbage. Pure garbage. Okay, so that's one local electrical battery. Now, let's take another local electrical battery. The Van Allen belts are two belts of charged particles moving around Earth, coupled to Earth's magnetic field. In fact, the reason they're in orbit around Earth is because they are high-energy particles locked in like a synchrotron situation around planet Earth, these charged particles moving in Earth's magnetic field that keeps them moving in circular orbits. Orbits we usually think of as gravitational. The objects like the moon is in orbit around Earth, so we usually think of the term orbit indicating that something is gravitationally bound. But you can have magnetic orbits also, where the charged particles are moving in circular or relatively kind of a donut-shaped orbit around planet Earth, and they pull together because of something known as the pinch effect, something that I identified early in my work as being very instrumental when you start getting plasma discharge and charges in outer space. Okay, so the Van Allen belts, you have a belt of electrons going one way and you have a belt of protons going the other way. Okay, so what do you have? A battery. That's another very good example of a local electrical battery. Now, what happens when an astronaut in a spacecraft tries to fly through the Van Allen belts? Well, what happens is it discharges that capacitor, like the backyard bug zapper. Okay, so the backyard bug zapper discharges, and in the primary charge carrier in that discharge, as with any plasma discharge, is in the form of electrons, because the electrons have a much higher charge to mass ratio than the protons. So the electrons have 2,000 times more. The current is 2,000 times more. It's not a higher number of electrons as protons. It's a higher velocity. There are many factors that contribute to current. One of them is the charge. The other one is the velocity. And so that's why in the solar wind, you have an excess current of protons. It's a situation that results from nuclear fusion in the atmosphere of the sun. Okay. There's another local electrical battery that you can find on Jupiter and Saturn as a result of their fusion in their atmospheres. Okay, but back to the Van Allen belts. So what happens when these electrons then hit metal in the spacecraft or whatever? They convert into, the energy converts into X-rays. And that's why it's very dangerous to try and send somebody through the Van Allen belts. I was just watching one of my videos that was taken in 2003 at the UFO Congress, and I was talking about the new head of NASA. The new head of NASA was asked, what's his most important endeavor as the new head of NASA? And he fired right back without thinking to learn how to get through the Van Allen belts. That was his main goal, and NASA put a lot of time and money into something called Living with a Star. It was a program. It was kind of a fancy way of saying, how do we get through the Van Allen belts. Well, if they went a dozen times with the Apollo program, everybody came back chipper and healthy, then what's the problem? You know, anyway, just another chalk up another problem for the Apollo program, that they literally did not know anything about the Van Allen belts, let alone how to go through it. And I can tell you a story. When I worked with Russian scientists in the mid-1990s, they were part of the Russian space program also, and they went, the Russians in the 1960s, long, long before the Apollo ever got off the ground, they sent men around the moon and back, and they came back very dead from extreme X-ray burns. And so they never went back. The Russians always had the capability of orbiting the moon. Landing on the moon is tricky, okay? Granted that. But going around the moon and coming back, not a big deal. If you can be in space, you can easily do that. So why don't they do that? Well, it's because of the Van Allen belts. One of the unsung problems of the space program. But anyway, getting back to the concept of local electrical batteries, the Van Allen belts constitute another local electrical battery around planet Earth. And knowing this, when I was doing my work, when I was at Cornell, I basically had free rein to do my work, to study, to advance all these concepts, because nobody else had a clue of what was going on. It's one of those cases of being in the right place at the right time with the data coming in, confirming everything that I was doing, but I couldn't talk to anybody there because there were a bunch of pompous NASA space scientists and astronomers and astrophysicists who didn't know anything and didn't know they didn't know anything. Their arrogance preceded them. I guess that's a good way to say it. So ultimately I identified 17 local electrical batteries, and these are plasma batteries that are around planet Earth, and that allowed me to develop the electric propulsion systems. One of them you can see in my book, Atlantis to Tesla. At any rate, running out of time here, got a few seconds left in this program. Just to remind you, go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. That's my main webpage. The water filter page, JMCC Water Filters, where you can get the best water filters on the planet. And you can use, for my audience, you can use the coupon code JMCC for a 5% discount. The JMCC coupon code on the webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. And I'm about out of time here, so we'll talk to you next week. And with a review of this, hopefully, of this intuitive machines landing on the moon, see what they see. We'll talk to you then. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.